You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So, in the Western culture, when you eat in a restaurant as a group, you always split the bill. But if one person offers to pay, you let them pay. But in the Asian culture, when you eat in a group, you never split the bill. One person offers to pay, but you're meant to fight that person. So they offer to pay, you're meant to say, no, I will pay. And they say, no, I will pay. And you say, no, I will pay. And you fight and you fight and you fight for that check. Now, as you know, I'm Asian, but brought up as a Westerner. So I can choose when to be Asian. And I can choose when to be Anglo. So in Australia, when I eat out with my Asian friends and one person offers to pay, that's when I choose to be a Westerner and I let them pay. See, culture is everywhere. And culture affects how we split the bill. And culture also affects how we tell people the gospel. So what we're going to do today is look at how we can connect the gospel to someone's cultural storyline. Because culture is everywhere. To explain, let me tell you this story. Imagine you're the youth pastor at this church. You run the youth group. I'm sure there must be a youth group here. And you're the youth pastor. Maybe there's not. I'm seeing smiles. But okay, you're the youth pastor at a church. And it's Friday night. And in walks into your group. In walks Jane. Jane is Asian, born in Taiwan, but grew up in America. Very preppy because she's 16 years old, but goes to a very preppy private high school because her dream is to study hard and get the grades she needs to get into law school at an Ivy League school. You're the youth pastor. What do you say to Jane? You say, oh, Jane, you have made study your idol. You need to get rid of your idol. Stop studying so hard. Instead, enjoy God and His creation more. Even better, if you're serious about following Jesus, give up studies altogether, go to seminary and become a youth pastor, just like me. That's what you say to Jane. Later that night, in walks Jack. Jack's from Southern California, but he's just moved into your town. Jack's dream is to drop out of high school at 16. He might pick up a trade because he is going to go surfing every day for the rest of his life. You're the youth pastor. What do you say to Jack? You go, ah, oh, Jack. You have made surfing your idol. You need to stop surfing. Instead, use your God-given talents to study, get a grade, go to college. In fact, if you're serious about following Jesus, you'd give all of that up altogether, go to seminary and become a youth pastor just like me. Can you see what's happened? We thought we were giving Jane the gospel. We thought we were giving Jack the gospel. But all we've done is ask Jane to become Jack and Jack to become Jane, because their culture was foreign to us, so we just reacted against it as if it was wrong. Even more, we thought we were telling them about Jesus. We thought we were giving them the gospel, but instead we were telling them to become just like us. We gave them our culture instead of the gospel. So how can we give the gospel to someone in their culture so Jane can stay Jane and Jack can stay Jack with the gospel? To do that, we need to learn the skill of what missiologists call contextualization. So what is contextualization? Contextualization is bringing the gospel to someone in their cultural storyline. And to understand contextualization, we have to understand how culture works in all our lives. Now, we know how it works. We know that when we tell someone the gospel, here's us, happy us. Here's the person listening to us with their ears listening. And here's the Bible, because it's got the gospel. Now, culture is everywhere. So we know the Bible has a culture. That's why when we teach Sunday school, we're forever having to translate the culture of the Bible for our audience. We have to say, oh, in those days, a tax collector was like that. In those days, a Samaritan was like this. Oh, in those days, a shepherd was like this. So there's a culture there that we're forever having to translate. We also know our audience has a culture. We know that. But what we forget is we have a culture. We're not neutral, divorced of a culture. We too have a culture. So when I lived in the United States for 5 years, I was doing PhD studies in Chicago. Americans would always come up to me and say, oh, I love your Australian accent. But then they would say, do I have an accent? And I thought, oh my goodness, they can't hear their own accent. Of course they have an accent. Even more amazing, I met a guy from California. And he tried to tell me in California, there is no accent. Because he said that's why they make movies from Hollywood. Because when people listen to a movie from Hollywood, the whole world hears no accent. It's the neutral accent for the world. And I thought, oh my goodness, not only can't he hear his own accent, he thinks his accent is the normal one. And everyone has the abnormal accent. And we too do the same. If we're not aware of our culture, we forget that our culture is everywhere and we act as if our culture is the normal culture and we impose it upon people as if it's the gospel. So we always look back at the missionaries from 200 years ago. We roll our eyes. We remember how, you know, they made them sing Western music. We think, oh, they impose their culture. But we always do the same. So I go to a Chinese church. I remember in Sydney, my seminary professor back then, he said to me, oh, what is it about you Chinese churches? Every time I go to a Chinese church to preach, they make me wear a tie and suit. And I said to him, well, who do you think it was that made the Chinese wear a tie and suit in the first place? I thought it was the missionaries, wasn't it? Because the tie and suit is not Chinese national costume. And because my seminary president was a Presbyterian, I said it was probably a Presbyterian missionary, wasn't it? So if we're not careful, we bring our culture along with the gospel. So how can we contextualize? We need to translate our culture, we have to translate the Bible's culture, and we also have to translate the culture of the people listening to the gospel that we're evangelizing. Now, to contextualize, Tim Keller puts it this way. He says it's like this spectrum where we're always juggling between over-adapting to someone's culture or under-adapting to someone's culture. So we're entering their culture with the gospel and we can always either over-adapt to their culture or we under-adapt to their culture. But deep down, we're trying to look for that Goldilocks sweet spot in the middle where we enter their culture with the gospel, but we also challenge their culture with the gospel at the same time. So if we over-adapt, then all we've done is enter, but we don't challenge their culture with the gospel. But if we under-adapt, then all we've done is challenge their culture with the gospel, but we didn't enter it in the first place. So we don't enter. So we're always oscillating between this. If we under-adapt, then they actually can't understand what we're saying. If we over-adapt, then they sort of misunderstand what we're saying. They think they've heard the gospel, but they really haven't heard the gospel. But if we get it just right, they really do understand the gospel. If we under-adapt to their culture, then we're asking them to give up what they don't have to give up, and we're asking them to do what they don't have to do. But if we make the opposite problem and we over-adapt, then we don't ask them to give up what they should have given up in their culture. And we also ask them to do, or we don't ask them to do what they should do. But if we do get it right, then we're asking them to give up what they should give up and do what they should do according to the gospel in their culture. So the missiologists would call this over-adaption then, well, this is syncretism, where you've just blended the gospel as if it's just one other thing they believe in their culture. But if we under-adapt, then what we've given them is legalism, because we're asking them to do things from our culture that they actually don't have to do in their culture, as if it was the gospel. But if we get it just right, then we get true contextualization. So what's interesting is sometimes we think, oh, this is just too hard. Why can't I just give them the gospel? And if I'm too hard a contextualization, then I risk being syncretistic. I've just blended the gospel with their culture. But the opposite of contextualization isn't the pure gospel. The opposite of contextualization is legalism. So it's not like the opposite problem is any better. It's still a problem. So we still need to work hard at getting that critical thing. And missiologists actually call it critical contextualization, where we haven't over-contextualized, we haven't under-contextualized, but we've got it just right. And we're always trying to get it right. And Tim Keller says we've got to be humble, because every time we stand here and we think we've got it right, there'll be a Christian over here who think, whoa, you've gone a bit too loose. And there'll be a Christian over here who think, oh, you're a bit too conservative. So somehow we're always having to be humble, but always fighting hard to get it just right. All right, so now we know what we're trying to do. We're trying to do contextualization. But to do that, we have to understand what is culture, and we need to know how to understand culture. So then the next thing then is, okay, what is culture? What is culture? How do we understand culture? So what is culture? What is culture? Well, one way of understanding culture is it's a worldview. It's a systems of beliefs of what we think are true, good, beautiful, real, valuable. And then this worldview will produce what we call texts that express this worldview. And texts don't have to be printed. Texts can be anything with a meaning. Clothing, music, dancing, poetry, architecture, inventions. They can be anything. But these texts express the meaning of that worldview. At the same time, these texts act on the worldview and shape the worldview as well. At the same time, the worldview gives you lenses that help you interpret the meaning in those texts as well. So it's this back forth. The worldview produces texts that express the meaning of that worldview. The text act on the worldview to shape the worldview, and your worldview gives you lenses by which you use to interpret those texts. So let's think of some examples. So let's think of a suit and tie. We use that as a text. So I go to a Chinese church where you have to be pretty formal. If you're preaching, you probably have to wear a suit and tie to speak in the Chinese congregation, because that says you take it seriously, you're respectful. That's what it says. But then one day I got invited to speak at a church on the beaches. So think something like Southern California. And it was a small church of about 100 people. And I thought, okay, it's a beach church. I will dress down. I would just wear something like this. I'll have a business college shirt, long sleeves rolled up, pants, leather shoes. I won't have the tie. I won't have the suit jacket. I turned up and the pastor looked at me and went, And I said to him, am I overdressed? He said, you are so overdressed. He was in shorts, flip-flops and a T-shirt. And he looked terrified. And I said, should I get changed? He said, oh, it's too late now. It's too late. But he just cringed because as I got up there in a shirt, I was too formal. And that said, I was disrespecting the people, patronizing them, holier than thou. Wow. So what would be respectful in this culture is disrespectful in this culture. Same text, but two different lenses by which to interpret it. Now, let's say you do want to wear a business shirt. Let's say next week you are going for the biggest job interview in your life. This is your dream job. You want to get this job. Now you have a choice. In your wardrobe, you have a white plain shirt or you have a shirt with a pattern. It's got colours. Hands up here, who would wear the white shirt to this job interview? Ooh, okay, hands down. Who would wear the coloured shirt? Ooh, wow, with a pattern. Okay, hands down. Very interesting, hands down, hands down. So people who choose the white shirt, that's a very Asian thing to do, by the way. Because it says, I'm a team player. I'm a conformist. You won't get any trouble from me. The coloured shirt says, hey, I'm an individual. I'm expressive. I've got good ideas. If you want to shake things up, come to me. That's what it's saying. But to this culture here, the Asian culture, you're going to be a troublemaker. Not going to give you the job. But in a very hyper-Western culture, the person in the white business shirt, boring, like, oh my gosh, we're not going to get anything useful or creative from that person. So again, same shirt, same text, but different worldviews will interpret it very differently. Oh, now let's think about the beach. Imagine we said now, okay, today's breakout session is not going to be here. We're going to find a beach. I don't know how, it's Ohio, but somehow we are going to find a beach. And this breakout session, we're going to just walk out there in shorts. We're going to be barefoot. We're going to walk across the crisp, cool sand. Above us is this blue sky, no clouds. The water's crystal blue and cool. And we walk out. We're knee deep. Now we're waist deep in this water. And we're just wearing a short sleeve shirt. Hands up here if that sounds pleasant. Okay, hands down. If you're Asian, that is the most unpleasant, stressful thing you can think about right now. Go say, sand, I'm barefoot. Now I'm going to bring sand in my car. I'm going to bring sand back into the house. We're going to scratch the furniture. What do you mean the sun is out and I'm going brown? Quick, get an umbrella up, put a long sleeve on. I'm in water. I can't swim. I'm going to die. I'm going to drown. Whoa. So again, same text. Very different interpretation of what's true, good, beautiful, real, and valuable. And maybe same thing. Think of sports. One day you're going to be a parent. You have a 10-year-old kid. Someone says to you, wow, I just saw your kid playing baseball. Whoa, very talented. Good arm, good swing. Now, who here feels good about that? Oh, majority. Thank you, hands down. If you're Asian, you're thinking, what do you mean my kid's playing baseball? They can get killed. That ball will hurt them. And what are they doing outdoors? They should be home getting math tutored. How are they going to get into law school if they're playing sports? All right, so same text, very different meanings of what's true, good, beautiful, real, and valuable. All right, so that is what a culture is. It's an interplay between worldview and text. Now we're going to say, okay, I know what culture is. How do I interpret culture? So at church, we learn how to interpret the Bible, but how do we interpret culture? All right, I'm going to give you three ways we can interpret culture. The first way is a very standard textbook way. But the second and third ways become more and more fun. So let's go for the first way. first way of interpreting culture, the standard textbook way is, well, let's look at themes in that culture. What does that culture say about God? What does that culture say about the world? What does that culture say about people? What does that culture say about death? What does that culture say about what's wrong with this world? And you can go on and on. And so that's a very standard way of understanding culture. Kevin Van Hooser, who teaches at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, he goes his way as well, but he likes to mix it up. Like, why stick with just these standard things? Why don't we think, hey, what does that culture say about cities, for example? Or what does that culture say about gardens? What does that culture say about gift giving? What does this culture say about age? What does this culture say about weddings? What does this culture say about funerals? So that's a much more sharp way of understanding culture. So cities, you know, two generations ago, the city was seen as a bad thing. The more upwardly mobile you got, the further away you move from the city. Then the millennials, they're doing everything to get back into the city. So something's changed. Gardens. I live on a street which is very multicultural. So the Anglo-Australians, oh, they pay a lot of money to make their gardens look just right. Whereas the Italians, they just pour concrete on it so they don't have to look after it. And the Chinese grow vegetables in it so they could sell it and monetize their gardens. Gift giving, very interesting. If I give a gift to you, do you have to give a gift back to me of equal worth? Different cultures say different things. In some cultures, if I came into your house and I said, oh, I like your painting, now you have to give that to me as a gift. In the Western culture, if I offer you a gift and you say no, that means no. In the Asian culture, if you say no, it means yes. It means no, okay. You can only say yes on the third time. So next time you meet an Asian, just remember that. When they said no, they didn't mean it. They really, really wanted that gift. Age is fascinating. Let's say we're on a plane and it's going down. And there's only one parachute. We only have one parachute. And you've only got two choices. Whose life do you save? There's an 8-year-old girl. And there's an 80-year-old man. Who here would give the parachute to the 8-year-old girl? Oh, thank you. Hands down, majority, right? Majority opinion. Why? Because she's got so much life to live. This guy, you've lived your life, all right? It was a good life, but you've lived it, all right? But in traditional cultures, it's more like, we have invested in this guy. He carries all our life experience and wisdom. You've got no life, no experience, no wisdom. You are expendable. So age, very different in very, very different cultures. All right, that's one way we can interpret culture, and I'm sure you can explore that further. The second way, I'm learning this from a guy called Paul Hibbert, anthropologist, missiologist, who used to teach at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. So number two, we're going to look at themes. I could have kept that word up, and counter themes. And the whole idea is every culture exists somewhere along the line of this spectrum. Along the lines of this spectrum between the individual, do we emphasize the individual or do we emphasize the group, the collective in this culture? In this culture, are we private emotions or are we public emotions? Do we believe in order and predictability, or are we a chaos culture? Do we believe that the material world is all there is, or do we believe there's also a non-material world? Do we emphasize this world, or are we otherworldly? So we believe that everything is secular space only, or is everything sacred space? Are we achievement orientated or are we acquirement orientated? Are we hierarchy or are we equality? Are we freedom or are we control? Are we universal big picture, or are we particular? All right, let's break this down. Individual, group, culture. So on a wedding day, whose day is it? Bride's day. Thank you. That's a very individual way of understanding the wedding day. One person, that's her day. Oh, you're in an Asian culture. On a wedding day, whose day is it? The parents' day. That's their graduation ceremony. Saying, thank you, look at us. We raised them and now they're getting married. How amazing are we? And so, if you get married in the Asian culture, you look at the invitation list, you think, I don't know, 80% of these people, they're your parents' friends. That's who they are. And you are forever fighting the parents. Do we have to invite Uncle Roger? Yes, we have to invite Uncle Roger. Okay, it's the parents' day. When you go to high school and you ask a high school counselor, what should I do when I grow up in the West? What do you want to do in Asia? What do your parents want you to do? That's a very group culture. All right, private emotion says, if you really believe it, you don't have to show it. You don't have to over-demonstrate it. Public emotion says, if you believe it, you will show it. And if you don't show it, you don't really believe it. So I used to work as a doctor in the emergency department. UK, Northern Europe, Scandinavia, private emotion. So you'd get an English gentleman turning up to the emergency department with an axe sticking out of their head, and they just wait patiently in queue. They come to the front, you say, what is the problem? And they would say, oh, there appears to be an axe sticking out of my head. And you would say, quite rightly, just come this way. Because private emotion, we were a private emotion culture. Other cultures, not so private emotion. If you're in pain, you should demonstrate your pain. So I remember one time I'm working as a doctor, nurse wheels in a youngish middle-aged woman in a wheelchair. She was from, let's say, a southern Mediterranean culture, clutching her chest in pain, going, ah, 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 relatives outside, like 20 relatives, because, you know, group culture. Anyway, so I say to the nurse, so what's the problem? And the nurse rolls her eyes and says, she thinks she's having a heart attack. Let's just put the EKG leads on and then put her back out in the waiting room. So we put the EKG leads on and she was having a heart attack, but we didn't believe her because she was too demonstrative about it. Like she was showing too much pain, because in a private emotion culture, you don't do that. Now, think about the worship wars. What were the worship wars really about? When you sing worship songs to God, should you be private emotion or should you be public emotion? So often what we think are theological differences are actually cultural differences. Now, order versus chaos. In the US of A, when you drive on a motorway or freeway, what do the lane markings mean? You better stay in your lane. And if you drift out of your lane, what happens? The car next is, bah, get back in your lane. Now, let's say in the Philippines, Peru, Vietnam, Tanzania, Kenya, what do the lane markings mean? Nothing. And they're thinking, gosh, why are there only 3 lanes here? We can fit 5 lanes in here. How inefficient is this? And what does the horn mean? The horn is just a friendly thing to say, I'm coming over, bum, 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 bum. And they all say, okay, I'm going over here then, bum, 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 bum. And they're like, fish. How much more efficient are fish in the water than 3 cars going rigidly in a straight lane? See, in that culture, chaos works better than order. Only fools would line up in a queue and take their time. So that's how a chaos culture works. All right, material, this worldly, says this world is all there is. There is no other world. There's no God. There are no angels. There are no demons. Secular space versus sacred space. Imagine if this church says, hey, let's not have this conference here in a church building. Let's just do it downtown on High Street. Who here would come? Okay, minority. But the rest of us think, dude, as long as we're not praying in public, all right, like, oh, because that's secular space. So now we're thinking we have a very strict secular sacred divide. You know, if you want to believe in Jesus, do that in the privacy of your own home. But don't bring it out in public, in libraries or schools or main streets. But other cultures, everything's sacred space. You know, your Muslim Uber driver, the whole taxi is sacred space. Your Chinese greengrocer, they've got a little statue set up. The whole shop is sacred space. The whole world is sacred space. All right, achievement, acquirement. Achievement means you need to earn your success, earn your qualifications. Acquirement, well, it's just much more important who your parents are. That's what really matters. Hierarchy versus equality. In the West, we're quite equality. The rest of the world is quite hierarchy. Freedom versus control. All right, so in Singapore, they banned chewing gum. And everyone happily obeyed. Why? Because it leads to public good. What's good for the group might not be good for the individual who wants to chew gum, but banning chewing gum is good for the group. It's a collectivist society. So they banned chewing gum. Now, in the US of A, like, it's all about freedom, isn't it? It's all about freedom. So you don't have to wear a helmet when you ride a motorbike. It's your head. Like, who are they to tell you what to do with your head? You got that state with a state motto, live free or die. Could you ban chewing gum in that state? I don't think so. So it's all about freedom, not control. And universal versus particular. Let's say you're caught speeding by the policeman or police person. All they care is about the particulars. You were speeding. Other countries, oh, your mother is the village chief. All right, well, that makes all the difference. So universal picture. Okay. Now, Jane and Jack. Jane comes from a group culture. She, from Taiwan, would be private emotion. She would be into order. She would believe there's a non-material world, other worlds, sacred space. She would be from an acquirement society. Her culture is high on hierarchy, high on control. And also the big picture does matter. Jack is a complete opposite. Jack from Southern California is a complete opposite. Now, in Sydney, this is true. And it's true in the UK and Canada. First thing you notice if you come to Sydney is, if you go to one of our university campuses in Sydney, there are Asians everywhere. There are more Asians here than Asia. What is going on? Everywhere. But then you go into a Christian group on your university campus and it's only Asians. You'd be the only white person in there. What's going on? Somehow, whether we like it or not, we have stumbled upon a very well contextualized gospel message to Asians who a group, private emotion, order, non-material, acquirement, hierarchy, control, and universal. They love this message we have. But Jack, on the other hand, the way we've under-contextualized the gospel is not working on Jack, because Jack is not Jane, Jane is not Jack. So we need to now rethink, how would we contextualize a gospel message to someone like Jack from Southern California? All right, that's the second way, themes and counter-themes. The third way is to ask, what is the storyline of this person's culture? Every culture can be understood as a storyline. They're living a story. What is a story? Tim Keller says, Little Red Riding Hood takes food to her grandmother. That's not a story. Bah, that's just an event, and it's boring. This is what you need for a story. You need three things. You need a mission, you need bad guys who stop you from achieving your mission, and good guys who help you achieve your mission. Little Red Riding Hood needs to take food to her grandmother, but a big bad wolf is waiting to stop her. But there's a hunter who saves Little Red Riding Hood, and now she can get food to her grandmother, who's dead already, but it's sort of like too late. But now you have a story. Now, every culture has a story. So let's go to Jane, preppy Jane. And let's go to Jack. What is Jane's storyline? What is her mission? Remember, it was to study hard and get into law school. What is she looking for? It's not law school, is it? Because really, it could be medicine, dentistry, engineering, accounting. So what is she really looking for? What is her mission? What is her happy ever after? What is she looking for? What does law represent for Jane? Achievement, success, security, all of those things, face, honor. So we can pick any one of them. They're all true. So we'll go, you know what? It's security. Law represents security to her. All right. Who are the bad guys in her culture? What will stop her from getting to law school? Youth pastor, that's right. So friends, parties, leisure, outdoors, sport. Who are the good guys in her culture? Who will achieve the storyline for her? Parents, authority figures, teachers, right. Okay, now, Jack's mission is to surf every day for the rest of his life. Who are the bad guys in his culture? Teachers, parents, authority figures. Who are the good guys in his culture? Friends, peers, parties, outdoor sports, leisure. Wow. Can you see how Jane's bad guys are Jack's good guys and the other way around? And we joked about youth pastor, but where would the church be in Jane's storyline? Would the church be a good guy or bad guy? By and large, a good guy. Represents stability, order, authority. So to run youth group at my Chinese church, we promise the parents there'll be time set aside for them to do homework. And they're so happy. So we're the good guys in their storyline. Where is the church in Jack's storyline? Bad guy, easy, authority figures who will take away his freedom. So once again, we're under-contextualized for someone like Jack's storyline. Okay, so how can we, now we've done how to interpret culture, I've given us three ways, how can we contextualize? How can we enter and challenge their storyline? So to do this, we need to resonate with their storyline and say, yes. Get them going, yes, that is my storyline. Then we need to, what I call dissonate, deconstruct their storyline. Get them to a ha moment. Never thought of it that way. And then we got to show them how Jesus fulfills, completes their storyline. He is the happy ever after ending to their storyline. He's the only way to achieve a happy ever after ending to the storyline, and is a better happy ever after ending to their storyline than they dared imagine. All right, so how would we match the gospel Jane storyline? We said, what is she looking for? And we said, well, it's security. And then we resonate with it. We show how in God's common grace, general revelation, this is a good thing. It's a truthful thing. It's a beautiful thing. So we can say things like, Jane, you're looking for security. And that's a good thing. Who doesn't want to be secure? And it's true that law does give us some sort of financial security. And this is God's way of blessing the world with justice. God brings love and mercy through justice. Through good lawyers. This is a good thing you want. So resonate with her storyline that security is a good thing to look for. But then you dissonate her by saying, but are you really going to find it through law alone? Because some of the most insecure people I know are doctors and lawyers because they're always moving the goalposts further and further and further away from them. And there's always another exam, another qualification. So it actually won't give you the security you're looking for. But Jesus will give you the security you're looking for. You'll be a child of God, a co-heir of Christ. This will give you the security and the status you're looking for. So that's one way of entering a storyline, dissonating it and giving Jesus as the ending. All right, how would you then contextualize a storyline for Jack? He wants to surf every day for the rest of his life. But is that really what he's looking for? What is he really looking for? Freedom. That's it. He's looking for freedom. And you say, Jack, that is a good thing to be free. God created us free. He gave us agency. It's true that we need to be free. But you only know what you're free from, parents, authority figures, teachers, you don't know what you're free for. You actually won't find the freedom you're looking for because whatever you chase will own you. Alexander the Great joked about the Persians, they'll always be slaves because they don't know how to say no. So sometimes it takes more freedom to say no to our desires than to just submit to them. You be owned by whatever you chase for the rest of your life. Only Jesus can fulfill you. And that's why Jesus says the truth will set you free. If we find Jesus, we have true freedom because we're not just free from, but now we're free for, free to live for Jesus. So that's one way of contextualizing the gospel into their storyline. So our mission, our vision is this. I think it's Acts 15. I always get it wrong. There's a council in Jerusalem in Acts 15 because the gospel started with the Jews, but then the Greeks started believing in Jesus. And the Jews are thinking, oh, I'm not sure about this. Like, do they need to become Jews before they can be Christians? And the council said, no, they can stay Greek in their culture and worship Jesus. In Revelation, we get the vision of languages, tribes, and people worshiping Jesus in their languages, tribes, and people groups. So somehow Jane can worship Jesus as Jane, the Asian American. Jack can worship Jesus as the Southern Californian. Jack doesn't have to be Jane. Jane doesn't have to become Jack. And they don't have to become you to worship Jesus. And finally, John 1, the Word becomes flesh. That means the gospel, Jesus, the Son of God, is translatable into each and every culture. So Tim Keller said, every other religion, every other God figure requires you, if you're to follow them, to become their culture. Only Jesus says, no, I will become your culture. So you can stay in your language, in your culture, in your people group, worshiping Jesus. So the challenge for us as evangelists then is how can we bring the gospel to people in their storyline so they can worship Jesus in their storyline without assuming our cultural storyline. Now, I've been here for several days and we've done a lot of stuff on evangelism. I've given us a lot of information. So we've all heard about IQ because IQ is high on information. But what I'm sensing here over the last few days is we also want to learn what we can call EVQ, evangelism intelligence. How I can be nuanced, read people, read the room, be sensitive to culture, discover the various metaphors there are for evangelism. So my friend Tim Chen, who's in the front row, and I, we've come all the way from Australia, but we have just set up in the last few years a school of evangelism called evq.org.au. So maybe after this, just go to evq.org.au, click on a coloured button. There's a coloured button there and you can take an evangelism barometer. You will be able to assess and gauge your own evangelism quotient and then it will send you some stuff, some to equip you to be an even better, hungrier evangelist than you are right now. So just go to evq.org.au, click on that button. It's just a 7-minute test. But why are you doing that? I'm hoping for question and answer time, but I don't know how we're going to do it. So might just go to the person and shout the loudest right now. Any questions? Yeah. Yes. Yes, so the question was, okay, we have to enter their culture. We have to make disciples of all nations because that's Jesus' call. But how do we do that if we have our culture and they have their culture? Is that the question? Yes, and that's why had I had a longer seminar, but right now we talk about culture. We need to know how to interpret the Bible in its culture. And today we looked at how to interpret our person's culture that we're telling the gospel to. But using those same tools, we can see our culture and then see what we're bringing along with the gospel. And maybe it helps if we're in a group. Maybe it helps the more and more we get out of our own culture and we're better able to read our own culture. So maybe it's better in groups and out of our own culture and we're more aware of our own culture. So what's interesting is I've lived in the United States for 5 years. You guys understand me just fine, don't you? My friend Tim Chen here, who's only been here for 3 days, you guys don't understand him, do you? No, because he hasn't been out of his culture long enough to know how to be understood by you guys, whereas I've been out of my culture long enough to know, okay, you're not going to understand that word, you're not going to understand that word, and you definitely don't talk that way. So that's it. If you can critically distance yourself from your own culture long enough, you soon know how to translate yourself. Yes, Chris. Yeah, so the question is, can Jack and Jane sit in the same church under the same Bible teachings? Well, if you go to a university college group, no, it's all Janes and no Jacks. No, but just kidding. And so that's the challenge, isn't it? Because there's no monolithic cultural group ever. And I think then, as evangelists, as teachers, as preachers, as pastors, what we can do then is when we speak to Jane, Jack will suddenly realize how foreign his culture is. I thought I was a normal one. And as you speak to Jack, Jane will start to think, oh, how foreign is my culture? I thought we were the normal culture. And what you can do is you can say, hey, I'm going to say this. Oh, but if you're not hearing it this way, that's because you've been in your culture too long. But hear how it sounds in another person's culture. And then people become bicultural, and they'll also realize their objections to Jesus are cultural objections. Because whatever objections you have, that person doesn't seem to have your same objections. So sometimes in question and answer time on university campuses, people ask me very good questions, but then I sometimes say, oh, I love your question, but you got to understand how Western your question is. Because someone in Africa doesn't have the same question that you have. So right now you have a Western hang up that's stopping you from seeing the gospel. Yes. Yeah. So the question is, I reference Keller a lot. Is there a specific book I read? No, it's an MP3. Just look at contextualization and evangelism, or contextualization and preaching, and you'll find an MP3. It's a double MP3. He gives two lectures on it. Yes.
Is there a Christ culture?
Is there a Christ culture, or are we over-spiritualizing our own culture? I love the way how Don Carson puts it. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, second person of the Trinity, transcends every culture, but he had to come to us in a culture. And all of us have to understand him in our culture. So even though he is transcultural and sits above our culture, we can never escape our culture, and we always have to approach him in our culture. So there's no, he is a transcultural truth, but that can only be understood culturally. And that's what John 1 says, the Word became flesh. So it's okay to understand him in our culture. And ironically, it doesn't say the Word became flesh. It says the Logos became flesh, which was a Greek metaphor loaded with Greek meanings. So even to say the Word becomes flesh, John has to grab a Greek cultural idiom to explain that transcultural truth to us. Yes. Yes. So the question or statement is, when Christ comes into a culture, he enters it, but he also challenges it. So it's both enter and challenge. And so every culture will have some overlap because of common grace, general revelation, there'll be goodness and truth there. But because of universal human depravity, every culture will have a way of suppressing God's truth or a way of running away from God's truth. But funny enough, every culture's way of expressing sin will be very different. So when Paul preaches in Acts 17, the thing that challenged them was the idea of a resurrection, like people rise from the dead. But I know if I went to a Chinese culture, they might not have so much of a problem with that. Their problem is what you're saying. Buddhism might be the cultural, like my parents are Buddhist. I don't think I could ever shame them by becoming a Christian. So that would be the objection for them. So every culture will be challenged in a different way. Yeah. So reincarnation versus resurrection. Yeah, that's right. But what I'm saying is every culture won't be exactly the same in its sinful expression. Oh, four hands went up at the same time. I'll go with you. Yeah, how does culture interpret the way someone sees the Bible? Big way. That doesn't trap us in agnosticism, now I can never understand the Bible, just means we need to be humble, work harder, and access the international community of interpreters. So not just see how Westerners have interpreted the same text, but how have other people interpreted this text? So David Clark, in his book on theological prolegomena, Know and Love God, brings this example up. He says, well, in John chapter 4, when Jesus says to the woman at the well, you know, you've had five husbands, the man you're with now isn't even your husband. In the West, traditionally, we have interpreted that as, okay, she's, you know, she's been unfaithful five times and now she's still unfaithful. Whereas other cultures might read that as, wow, five men have left her. And now the man she's with won't even do her the dignity of marrying her. So somehow different cultures give us different cultural lenses. And sometimes there's not enough information to let us know which way. But just to know, yes, we do bring baggage with us into the text. Yes, correct. Yes. Yeah, so the question is, so, like, what stage does this become unworkable? We don't have one, two, four cultures. We have hundreds of different cultures. I think what I'm saying here is you just have to be aware there is culture and just work harder at it. Otherwise, we'll be like the youth pastor talking to Jane and Jack as if I have no culture. So I think it begins with me knowing, first up, I have a culture that I bring, and how can I now be more thoughtful in how I enter this other person's culture? And just know, culture is everywhere. It's not like we're in this neutral, culture-free void. Yeah. So the question is, okay, culture is everywhere. How do I even begin? And how can I show them, okay, this objection, it's not an unovercomable objection. I know that's not what you said, but that's my summary of it. What I'm sensing here is because this has been a lot of information, a lot of new information, we're a little bit overwhelmed and we're a little bit destabilized. What the aim of today is actually to encourage, empower, and equip us to say, oh, maybe what I do need to know now, it's not a one-size-fits-all. The gospel presentation that worked for my father 50 years ago might not be the best gospel presentation for a person right now. That's all I want to take home. And now my job is to be a better hearer of this person. So when I see Jane, I don't just see someone, she wants to study hard and she wants to go to law. I would just pull out the same tract my father had 50 years ago. Instead, I just try to think, okay, she wants to study law. Why does she want law? Why is it? Okay. It represents security. Her parents have moved out with this dream. It's a collective society. The parents have sacrificed. If she gets into law, it honours the parents. It's not her decision to make. It's also her parents' decision to make. And it's a way of honouring and repaying her parents for the sacrifices that they made by moving from a well-paying job in Taiwan to come to the USA. That's her storyline. How can I show her Jesus will fulfil that storyline? That Jesus will give her the honour she's looking for, the status and security that she's hungering for. How can I do that? And then when Jack walks in, you think, punk, just wants to surf every day, dripping salt water here on the church carpet. What are you doing? No, hang on. He's a 16-year-old boy from maybe he's got an over-domineering father, not doing well at school. He's always being yelled at. He's 3 hours in the water. It's his escape. He's looking for shalom. He's actually looking for peace. He's actually looking for order in a world of chaos. How can I show he just needs to come a bit further and find Jesus? So it's like Jesus to the woman in the well. Oh, you've come for water. Don't you get it? You're going to stay thirsty. What are you doing? No, okay. Water is good, but you're going to stay thirsty. Just come a bit further. Come a bit further. Taste and see. I've got springs of living water. that will well up to eternal life. So I'm saying that's what we can do. Instead of not understanding someone, try to understand them. What is the God-given, legitimate, existential cry that would make them want this lifestyle to be true? Why would they want this to be true? There's a God-given cry in there. And if we can show them, just come further this way and you'll find Jesus. It's like Paul in Athens. He sees an idol. Oh my gosh, an idol. Idols everywhere. Even one to an unknown God. Oh, but I see you guys are religious. You actually want to please the gods. You're looking for worship. But how are you going to worship God you don't know? Come over here. Come. And I'll show you God you can know. And you actually can't even contain him in this temple. He's bigger than that. Imagine having this God in your life. And so that's actually what I'm saying. Don't be overwhelmed by cultures. Oh, I never understand them. No. Say, I can do this. I can actually do this. If Jesus the Logos could become flesh and learn how to speak Aramaic, I think I can actually learn a new culture and just hear their cry. What are they looking for? And show how Jesus is the happy ever after they're looking for. All right, thank you very much. You guys have been wonderful. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.